You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where even our missteps are successes. I'm your host, Justin M. Wisniewski, and if you enjoy your trip into the midside here today, I'd love it if you would tell a friend. I love having more people who are listening to the show and interacting with us. I had a lot of interaction with all of you post Justice League, and it actually helped me. Supposed to have art that fed the soul, but instead it was our interactions that fed the soul. So let's keep growing this community we've started here. Joining us, because as I said, this is a community, joining us on this trip from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards.
Indeed, and it takes a village to make fun of the world. So
here we are. We certainly saw what happened.
Our little weird village,
yes. But not as weird as the village that Joss Whedon and Geoff Johns have created. We saw what happened when they thought it took a village. Also joining us this trip, from somewhere in the Bay in the South, because again, I don't really know where he lives anymore. Midsider William Green.
Welcome everyone to the Midside, and thanks for having me back. I'm actually in Michigan this weekend visiting family over the Thanksgiving break. My sister was in town as a surprise for my parents from Germany. She's been stationed there for a while. So a nice quick trip. Get to hang out with my brothers and sisters. And I'm sure we'll talk more about that in the Reddit section today.
Interesting. I was wondering if you were going to have something to say for the Reddit section. So that is good to hear.
Oh, yeah.
I have to ask you, though, since you're in Michigan right now, is everything okay there? And I'm not saying this to talk shit, because you know I love Michigan because you guys gave us Tom Brady. But it's like, what is it, 13 out of 14 years you guys have lost to Ohio State now?
You mean the team to the south. And yes, there's a malaise. At my little town I grew up in, that's where I am right now, in the hotel in Durand, Michigan. And it's a quality inn. It's quality, let me tell you.
It's in the name.
Right there in the name. At the Wendy's, they had a contest, signs hanging up, you know, like you get, if Michigan wins the big game, free, you know, Frosties. And then, but this year, I haven't been here in a while, but this year they also had a note underneath saying, well, if they don't win, you can still get them for 50 cents. So.
That's so sad.
It is very sad.
A maze malaise hanging over.
Yep.
Michigan.
We need to make Michigan.
That was good.
Make the Wolverines great again. We need to do something.
No, bad. Bad William. All right, let's talk about other things that probably don't need to be made great again. It's time for the news with Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad.
Is the outside racist? That's basically the question of an article written by Malcolm McCann in a student newspaper out of Claremont Colleges. Why are we covering a student newspaper? Because today's student newspaper articles are tomorrow's Huffington Post hit pieces.
Is there a difference?
So we're just getting a preview.
Between student newspapers and regular newspapers anymore?
Just the amount of pay, I suspect.
They're both zero.
And by
that,
I mean that student editors, well, I'm assuming student editors get paid something per issue, whereas Huffington Post contributors do not. So this is a preview of what's to come in the left, and this is a fun article about outside privilege. So
sent
the article begins like this.
Midsider Alfred.
Oh, sent to us by Midsider Alfred. Yes, thank you for that, as I and want to forget attribution as to make everything look like it is my genius idea. Okay.
You should attribute to the fact that I gather the news most weeks. Well, let's talk about that privilege. How about the speaking voice privilege that you have on this show?
Yeah, but your gathering of the news is made eloquent by my voice, and thus I'm the real star here.
Okay, well, I don't disagree with the eloquence. I disagree with who the real star is, but continue.
Comfort in a space is a privilege, the article begins. Like many forms of privilege, it is left unobserved and overlooked by those who have it. People at the five C's, meaning the five Claremont colleges, feel comfortable in the spaces they can claim ownership over and uncomfortable in spaces where they cannot. So far, this article is basically A is A. Okay. But here's where it starts to go off the rails. It talks about how the five C's have prominent outdoor programs and basically says that these extracurricular activities, while they're open to all people, are predominantly white spaces. Both clubs claim to be accessible. While trips are open to any student wanting to go, not everyone feels the same ease in entering the outdoors. This discomfort is unfortunately caused by existing racial boundaries. Historically, white people in imperialist conquests have appropriated land as their own. North America rightfully belongs to the indigenous communities, yet has been taken away from them by force. Consequently, a false sense of ownership of nature permeates white America. The whiteness manifests, I love this, in the term outdoorsy, a descriptor for those who spend a significant time in the outdoors, who are equipped with the necessary gear, and who feel connected to nature. The image of the, quote, outdoorsy individual is an exclusive classification that gives white people the authority to venture into the outdoors freely, leaving people of color behind. Justin, do you, when you're driving out to the country, do you have to actually check in at these racial barriers? And, like, declare, like, what fruit you've brought from other counties and whatnot, like coming back from Vegas into Los Angeles. Like, I mean, you have to literally check in at the racial barriers to the outdoors.
I live in California, so that's not a fair question. Like, I have to check in if I, like, want to, like, park somewhere.
That's true.
So that's not...
You want to breathe the air? You're going to need a license.
Exactly. So that's not a very fair question. But what is a fair question, especially in regards to California, is homelessness. So, you know, Mayor Vera, whatever the fuck his name is, right? He's all about homelessness.
Garcetti.
It's Garcetti now? Oh, sorry. I apologize. I'm racist. No.
Villa Ragosa was your last terrible mayor.
No, so which is the one that wants to run for president? Is it Garcetti?
Garcetti. And he does nothing but think about the homeless all day.
Right. Well, and that's the thing I want to ask Garcetti. Do you have to be a certain race to be homeless? Because according to this article, you would have to be white to be homeless, wouldn't you?
Well, homeless is different than camping.
You're the only one who can actually get outdoors, right? Yeah.
No, I'm not saying they're the same thing, but to be homeless, you have to live outside. So if, like, only white people are comfortable in the outside, only white people can be homeless.
I'm just imagining the force shield that is protecting the great outdoors from people of color. Like, some sort
that's
of barrier.
Probably... One of the most absurd sentences in this entire article is this one. Due to the predominance of whiteness in the outdoors, people of color have been denied access to the outdoors. Denied access to outside.
Well, so I want to ask you, Daniel, is this why you hate the outside? Is your half Mexican side terrified of the white people outside?
Apparently that must, I mean, I didn't know that explicitly, but that must be the case. That must be why when I step outside, I have this sense of impending doom, and not because historically nature has been the number one killer of human beings.
Well, that's what I want to ask you about. That's what I want to talk about. Hasn't the history of humanity been a race to get inside? Like, haven't we been trying to get in, like, when we were, like, being chased by dinosaurs? And yes, I know humans and dinosaurs didn't live together. Fuck off. When we were being chased by giant creatures, didn't we try to get to the cave beforehand? Like, I saw the Croods, and I'm pretty sure that was a documentary.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think that the...
About the...
The difference here between the student version of the newspaper and the future upcoming Huffington Post one is that it didn't talk about how there's not enough trans representation in the outdoors. So this is, they left out the whole male privilege aspect of this. So in fact, they even have two men in the graphic.
I know. It's insane. The amount of sexism in this article, really, it's just women have been totally denied access to the outdoors, which is ridiculous. You know, I find this insane overall that the outdoors is racist. Not the least of which because not the least of which is because my whole thing about camping and the whole thing about being outdoors is it takes nothing really to do it if you want to do it. And yet it's seen as some major activity that requires equipment and whatnot. And that's ridiculous. The reason that there's this quote unquote whiteness barrier is because the white take on going outdoors is you have to have a 900 square foot tent with an indoor heater and a generator so you can still play Xbox and whatnot. If you want to go outside and go camping, you just need a fucking blanket. Do you have access to a blanket? Then you, sir, racial minority or not, may go camping. That's what it takes.
And that's the angle they should have taken with this article. There is an angle to do with race and going outside and camping, and you've hit it on the head, Daniel. White people do not want to camp anymore. They want to pretend to be poor.
Yes, yes.
It's what you're talking
about. You just stole the Carlos Mencia joke that he stole from numerous other comics. But yes, go ahead.
Did I?
Yes.
Oh, that must have been in my subconscious because I've been saying that since undergrad. Because I remember undergrad, I was talking to somebody and she was like, yeah, you know, my family's, we're just out right now. We're out camping. I was like, why are you on your phone? She's like, oh, well, we have a hotspot set up because we have our RV here. So you're not camping, you're pretending to be poor. Like, that's what they do. It's what you said. Like, they go and they set up the PS4 and the DirecTV satellite and everything. It's just, it's ridiculous.
I guess I'm the only one here.
Do you have a blanket and a cup?
Camping and goes camping, because I do go camping. And we definitely take the generator, but not for the Xbox. Okay. Although...
Well, it's also different. This is also a difference, William, of regions of the country. So let's be clear here that this article was written by a student newspaper in Southern California, a consortium of colleges in Southern California, which sounds like hell to me. Like, if you want to figure out how to make Southern California worse, get all the colleges together and start publishing things. Yeah. But William, this is the perspective of people in Southern California. You're from Michigan, where people actually camp and there's actual wilderness.
Well, that's one of the reasons the article says that the outdoors is racist, is because the outdoors isn't close enough to the cities.
Yeah, how dare it? Also, I want to look at just, like, usually we have so much subterfuge and emotionalism in these kinds of articles. This one is actually laid out logically. It's just that none of the things are connected logically, if that makes sense. Like, I love the jump from that there's racial boundaries, and the racial boundaries is because white people are imperialist. Like we just jump, like it's like, wait, but that's okay. That's a historical thing. Okay. So how does that connect to the outdoors being racist? And did people of color never conquer
anything
ever? How did
we cross the boundaries, by the way?
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Does anyone in modern inclusivity talk remember the goddamn Persian Empire? If I was Cyrus the Great, I would be rolling over in my grave right now for all the imperialism that the Persians did. No one fucking talks about that. It's only white people who ever conquered anything, apparently, in the history of the world.
Well, and that's the question I have about all this that you're talking about, William. So the connection is between minorities feeling uncomfortable and the white imperialism. So do when minorities go outside... And I'm not saying this to be funny, but it is funny because it's ridiculous. Do they feel uncomfortable because they just think of white imperialism?
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. I know we're trying to bring reason to this, but, like, let's just say it explicitly. This is nothing to do with race. It has to do more with class and, like, geographic location. Like, I'm in Michigan right now, and there are tons of people of color that go camping in Michigan. Like, it's pretty much the same percentage of people that you see in the general population in Michigan. It's not you're going to see more white folk than black folk, for example, but not a lot of people that live in Detroit go camping, right? It's mostly the people out here in the counties that go camping.
This is one of the other things, which is, like, is it okay if different groups of people, be they different races, genders, locations, whatever, is it okay that they have different interests? Must all people in all region have the same percentage of interest as all people in all other regions of the country, or all other races, or all other genders, or all other occupations, whatever it is? Or are we allowed to have different interests?
No, we are not allowed to be an individual. You must all be judged according to race and culture and fit in the hierarchy of victimhood.
Yes. This is one of the key indicators why this article is a giant piece of bullshit, which is that their first solution to this problem, by the way, is that these outdoor groups should continually affirm that nature exists as a collective space owned by all by virtue of being human. If it's owned by all by virtue of being human, how did the white imperialists take it away from the rightful owners of who were the indigenous people? Boom! Sorry. I hate that stupid argument.
Well,
nature,
I mean,
is
it's
not
even worse
owned
than that.
By the,
like,
the your nature, your virtue of being a human being, because you were fucking shat out of a vagina, it does not mean you own anything in the world. That's
right.
Fucking ridiculous.
Because what they've done is essentially undermine property rights, correct? Like, how can you have a house then? How do you, if nobody can own the outdoors, then you can't have an indoors. Fuck off.
Yeah, it's all a bunch of Marxist bullshit, which is why the article overall is terrible, but it's hilarious. Nonetheless, here you go, HuffPo. Hire this guy to write your inane shit. Speaking of inane shit, I don't know. I felt like I ran out of steam there. This cuts me deep.
About this article.
This cuts me deep. John Lasseter is taking a leave of absence from Pixar amid, quote, missteps. Here we go. You can do this, Daniel. You can do this. Okay. Disney animation head John Lasseter is taking a leave of absence from Pixar after acknowledging, quote, painful conversations and unspecified missteps, he wrote in a Tuesday in a memo to staff. Lasseter's statements arrived at the Hollywood Reporter after there was a story alleging basically sexual misconduct by Lasseter. Apparently, and it was actually kind of hard to find what the missteps were, he was well known around the company to be the guy who would, like, inappropriately put his hand on someone's, like, a woman's thigh, and he would often, when he was hugging a woman, hug her longer than normal and whisper quasi-sexual things into her ear. So Lasseter said in his statement, quote, I've always wanted our animation studios to be places where creators can explore their vision with the support and collaboration of other gifted animators and storytellers. Okay, so far he said nothing. He wants to have that culture, blah, blah, blah. He's a leader, blah, blah, blah. He's supposed to make sure that that happens, and now he believes he is falling short in this regard. He's recently had a number of difficult conversations that have been very painful. It's never easy to face your missteps, but it's the only way to learn from them. As a result, I've been giving a lot of thought to the leader I am today compared to the mentor, advocate, and champion I want to be. It's been brought to my attention that I have made some of you feel disrespected or uncomfortable. That was never my intent. So, Justin, when will the madness end?
I don't have an answer to that question because this madness, to me, has gone way too far. So we've talked about this before with, like, Dustin Hoffman, where we're like, where is the line here? And, you know, something I brought up in that case was I didn't think Dustin Hoffman really did anything legally wrong. I think he may have done things morally wrong. But to put him on display and on trial in the media, in the news, seemed absurd to me. And this seems like an even worse situation here. My question about this is, why did this need to be public? It doesn't seem like he did anything that needed to move beyond HR in the company, pulling him aside and having a meeting, and then he would release a statement inside the company. Why did this have to happen publicly?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't have an answer to that other than the fact that the floodgates of Harvey Weinstein have now opened up every uncomfortable behavior to a public trial. So,
well, and I
oh, right, and that's really go ahead. Wait.
I was gonna say, I don't know if you guys are following the related story. Like at first, when that story broke from a Hollywood Reporter, they were saying they were connecting it to Rashida Jones leaving Pixar's Toy Story 4, And they had to quickly like backtrack that there was, because they were saying, oh, it must have been over allegations. And this is the quote from Jones from that related article. It says, the breakneck speed at which journalists have been naming the next perpetrator renders some reporting irresponsible. We did not leave Pixar because of unwanted advances. That is untrue. We parted ways because of creative and, more importantly, philosophical differences. There's so much talent at Pixar, and we remain enormous fans of their films. However, it is also a culture where women and people of color do not have an equal creative voice.
Wait, why is Rashida Jones using we in this statement?
Also, why are we trying to balance women with people of color for equal creative voice? That seems really weird to me.
Yes.
I mean, I do think we could maybe connect the dots here, and maybe they're going after Lasseter because this is just the latest excuse social justice warriors have to tear people down. So they're using this as an excuse to target Lasseter.
Yeah. Could this be a reaction? Maybe Lasseter was defending a meritocracy and he just needed to go. Because I just want to explain this for one second, because this is what we saw in the Marvel comic, in Marvel comics, right? If you're white and male, you're basically not allowed to write comics anymore at Marvel. And so what we've seen is, a lot of social justice comics and a lot of just really bad comics and comic sales ever since they removed the merit requirement and put race and minority status ahead of it. So if Lasseter was one of those leading voices, holding back that tide of, well, we've got to get a rainbow up here and sacrifice the product, then maybe this is a move to get him out of the way.
Well, isn't Lasseter the guy who did the Incredibles, Daniel?
Well, he's basically done pretty much all the Pixar stuff. I mean, it's hard to say where Lasseter's influence begins and ends because he has such an influence on all the stories that come through Pixar and Disney Animation Studios. Brad Bird is the guy you're thinking of, though, specifically, who's done the Incredibles and also Tomorrowland and stuff like that. But he had to hire Brad Bird, so.
Right.
Brad Bird white? Maybe that was the problem. Interesting notion. Well, he's definitely white. He's Whitey McWhiterson. And for anyone who doesn't know what we're talking about, Brad Bird is the director who is accused of being an objectivist because of the message of The Incredibles and of Tomorrowland and some other things he's done, and he had to like quickly distance himself and come out and be like, oh God, no, please, no, anything but Ayn Rand.
Oh, I didn't know he was actually accused of that.
Yeah, there's a couple articles you can find about it.
What about Tomorrowland? Yeah. Did they say it was objectivist? I didn't watch it, but I find it hard to believe that Lindelof would let something be objectivist that he wrote.
It's a Galt Gulch-esque land of scientists and whatever who are hiding themselves away from society because it's irrational. And they, in their Galt Gulch-esque land that's like super advanced and has like technology that could save the world, it's just no one wants it.
Okay.
Like it's almost right out of Hell and Shrub.
Yeah, I can't argue with that.
Yeah. So anyway, what was I going to say about this? I don't remember any more. Oh, yeah. If anyone out there has actually seen an article with credible accounts of what has happened with Lasseter, I would be interested to read it because I'd like to know the extent to which he's done bad things, you know, because he's a hero of mine. But I can't find anything that's beyond what you were saying, Justin, that's beyond an HR issue. Basically, you know, having a talking to with the guy and saying, like, look, John, like, you're hugging girls too long. It's making them uncomfortable. Let's not do that. Does anyone have it? Because I'd be curious to read it. And we'll put it up at themidside.com because we're a show about nothing but accuracy here. So, yeah. But otherwise, I'm baffled as to why this gets the same level of reporting as Kevin Spacey or anything else. It's insane.
Well, do you think there's a cultural recalibration going on? And what I mean by that is, for so long, Hollywood and the media has gone after the alpha type, and they've really demonized alpha sexuality. I mean, when we talk about masculine sexuality being demonized and masculinity being demonized, it's really the alpha conception of it, right? It's the aggressive, assertive type of male. Whereas you look at the techniques that Lasseter was being accused of using. And I'm not saying Lassiter's an alpha or a beta. I don't know him. But I'm saying specifically the techniques they're saying where he hugged for too long and he rested a hand on the thigh or things like that. Those are more like beta type techniques where you're not being aggressive and saying you're interested or making comments. So is this just a recalibration where now we're hypersensitive to this other side and these other male sexuality techniques?
I guess. I mean, I would say that more generally speaking, I think it's just a general attack on male sexuality, whether it's aggressive or passive or,
oh,
or
no,
alpha
I agree
or
completely.
Beta or any of the terms were, yeah.
They're using, yeah. That's what I'm saying, they've been attacking male sexuality, but for years, Hollywood, because it was run by betas, as we saw with Harvey Weinstein, you know, Harvey Weinstein techniques are the ultimate beta techniques and the ultimate beta predator, but they've demonized alphas as if they were all predators. Because just like there can be male predators, there can be female predators, there can be predators of any race, any religion, right? There can be alpha predators and beta predators. But for years, they've been saying the alpha type, they're all evil. They're all jerks. They're all rapists. And now I'm just saying they're using that as a guise to now say even the male allies. So rather than saying, as we talked about before with a Pharisee and a Whedon, maybe these guys are using it as a cover. They're projecting and their male allies, there we go, said it properly, of feminism because they think all men are like them because they're projecting. Rather than go that route, women are just saying, or the feminists, not all women, but the feminists are just saying, oh, now all men are like this. Even the ones who are our allies are toxic and we're definitely in a rape culture 100%. So they're making it seem like guys are even worse. And now specifically because it's in vogue with the media, it's like betas are in the crosshairs. That's what I'm arguing. So I'm saying the same thing you are. I'm just being more specific.
Sounds like you. Yeah. mm-hmm. I don't know where a lot of this is coming from. And I'm just sort of sitting here waiting to see if this is... I mean, I told you a few weeks ago that I didn't think this was going to be the end of the producer stuff in Hollywood, that we were going to see a lot of it. But the sort of question is like, well, where is this going to end? And what are the norms going to be after this whole thing ends? We had that article a few weeks ago about this, how this is the anti-sexual revolution. And that's not necessarily a good thing. But like, I mean, Adam Kroll said something on his show. Someone marked the time. First Adam Kroll reference of the show. Is it like any kiss, quote unquote, an unwanted kiss, like the first time, basically? Or like, especially if it's someone who you're not attracted to. It's an unwanted kiss if you, the woman, are not attracted to him. But if it's an unexpected kiss and you are attracted, then it's, quote unquote, not unwanted. How do we avoid that as a culture? It's not possible. It's literally not possible to have male-female interactions if our boundaries for sexual misconduct are any unwanted advances, period. The end.
Well, right. But this goes back to what I said a long time ago, and I've said many times, and something I dealt with. It's the idea of all the power being shifted to the female, that she gets to be the complete gatekeeper or not. You know, because the male has the power, conventionally, the male has the power of choice and the woman has the power of rejection. But if you make it so the man cannot make a choice unless he already has the woman's permission, well, you've taken away the male power in courting and in relationships. And that's what it ultimately devolves to.
Yeah. It seems to me like even saying like take away the male's power is like it underplays how bad that would be culturally. Like just like the idea that any approach that's unwanted is sexual misconduct would break down. I mean, this is going to be really hyperbolic, but it would break down the entire fabric of culture, of society. Like that, it would be insane. Because it's not going to stop here, right? Like you don't stop at the sexuality thing. You take this in everything. One of our themes this entire year has been interpersonal hostility. Well, every approach now, every handshake, every business gesture, every interaction with another human being, if it's unwanted, that's going to be misconduct. That's where it's going.
Yeah, but that's how you get these people. I mean, that's why you end up with a Devin Faraci and a Joss Whedon. Like, I keep going back to them because they're examples of it. I mean, look at the worlds they create or look at the philosophies they want advocated in art because they've internalized that. That's how you end up with the hugs that are too long and the touches on the thighs. Because if as a guy you don't feel like you have permission unless you're allowed, and it's an innate desire you have, right? This is something that you have a drive, and you can't stop that drive. You're going to find ways around it, and it's going to be these creepy, disgusting, non-consensual ways of doing things. Yeah. You know, fortunately, that they're so internalized that they've become super beta rather than being a predatory, overpowering rapist. But this is where it becomes. You can only have interpersonal hostility, and you become this type of person who, yeah, you want to create that type of art, and that's the world you live in where everything is combative. That's why the society we live in has art that's about the haves and the have-nots, and the powerful versus the non-powerful, and it's a constant battle because that's the world they live in.
This goes back to something, I forget who it was at Clemson, Justin, you'll remember, but like it's always resonated with both you and me, in talking about how capitalism is and how like this capitalist culture is framed versus a collectivist culture or socialist culture. And the capitalist culture is always framed as, oh, it's every man for himself, and it's the war of the individual against the individual. And this unbridled competition just creates hostility between everyone. But in reality, it's collectivism in its entirety. It's collectivism per se that creates the war of every person against the other person, because it's all entirely group welfare, and you as an individual have to be part of a group. And now, if we're making the groups large enough, like for instance, all men, you're necessarily going to create interpersonal hostility. And why more people don't recognize that it is this collectivist notion, this Marxist idea of group warfare that creates this hostility is beyond me. It's so obvious.
Yeah. So, I mean, the question is ultimately how to move forward, right, as a guy in this culture. And what I would say is just, you know, have the confidence in yourself and the confidence in you know, what you are. You know, A is A. What is your identity? And you have a right to feel attraction. You have a right to express it. So express it in healthy ways and express it in productive ways. And, you know, be careful of your surroundings, not because you believe other people are going to be hostile, but just where is it appropriate and where isn't it? And don't be one of these people who, because you feel like you can't express it all the time, that you have to express it at inappropriate times. There's definitely a lot of that in our culture where, ironically, you know, we're post-sexual revolution, but we as guys are made to feel like there are times when it's, you know, or no, there it's always inappropriate to express, so we feel like we have to get it in, pun intended, I guess, when we
careful.
And, and that's where you see a lot of guys. Like, I know I'm a guy and I'm out there and I'm like, why are guys saying these things at this time and to these women and in this way? But I get it. It's because they don't feel like they can any other way. And that's the way they have to feel like they have to be. So just be in control of yourself and be confident in yourself.
How dare you? It's a hate crime.
William,
well,
do you
speaking
have
of bringing up things,
hold
that,
on. William, do you have anything you want
to
add,
William,
before we move on?
No, you're ruining a perfectly good transition.
Speak up for yourself. Yeah, Justin, way to ruin my transition. I agree with everyone.
All right, I guess William's staying silent on this.
I love delay. That's my favorite thing about technology is delay.
Well, I was going to say,
Go ahead, William. I will wait silently while you speak.
It's hard to imagine the kind of twisted way that you have to interact with people. And it's hard. I see it as a kind of an outsider, right? Because I don't try to approach women, obviously, at least not for sexual stuff. But even I get the uncomfortable stuff. Women are uncomfortable around me for no reason, right? And that always seems surprising to me that the default is all males are predators. And I think that these stories are sensationalized in such a way that make that true. And I think that's one thing that we've always pointed out on the show is that this is a specific type of guy. This is a specific individuals. And we need to make sure that, you know, we don't ruin the whole culture in the name of, they are bad people.
Yeah. Speaking of ruining the culture. There we go. Apparently, it is your civic duty to ruin Thanksgiving by bringing up Donald Trump. Thanksgiving is over, but I'm sure that many of you out there had wonderfully pleasant conversations about politics with your family. And if you brought up Donald Trump and how terrible he is, then GQ wants to thank you. They write the article, it starts, "It's late November, and you know what that means. Every man you've seen on TV for any reason has just been unmasked as a woman-hating sewer ghoul. So you know where this article is going. Also, it's time to ruin your Trump-supporting family's Thanksgiving for America. Thanksgiving is a celebration of community and gratitude where we reconvene in our nostalgia-drenched hometowns and perform time-honored traditions such as almost sleeping with your high school crush and going around the table to say what you're most thankful for and where you were on 9/11. Pause. Does anyone just deeply and vehemently hate this person already? Like, I don't think I've ever felt hatred for a writer more than I do for this human being writing this article. This article is just dripping with this self-satisfied, I'm better than you, I can condescend to you because I'm super smart attitude that I just fucking despise in writers. Anyone else?
Yes.
I mean, I get that sense that you're talking about. I don't hate them for it, though. I just don't, like, I don't understand how somebody who thinks they're so smart can be so stupid. Like, have you guys ever had a conversation with your family on a holiday or with anyone on a holiday about where they were on 9/11? Like, is that in the top 100 list of conversations?
No, I don't think it's come up. I'm not sure my family knows I was alive on 9/11.
I don't think I've ever discussed politics at a holiday. There's so many other things to talk about. Like, interesting things.
Yes. That's right. So his whole thing, he goes through this list of, he mocks Trump and his climate change denying EPA chief and his labor secretary who opposes minimum wage increases and the, quote, flagrantly Islamophobic national security advisor who might as well be a foreign agent, blah, 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 blah. And he says, last year, Trump supporters could still make the case for impending change. Perhaps Trump would go through a molting phase, shedding his most intolerant and unstable parts like clumps of dead lizard skin. Instead, if anything, his reptilian hide got doused in nuclear waste, and he has since Godzilla'd all over America's purple mountain majesties. Pause again. When you write that sentence as a writer, Justin, could you as a human being look at that sentence and say, I am satisfied that this sentence communicates not only what I want to say, but also that I'm not an abhorrent douche? Because that's really what that sentence communicates.
If I was trying to write like Japanese anime erotica, I would feel okay with that sentence.
Godzilla'd all over America's purple mountain majesties.
Yeah, I mean, think about that. Reinterpret that in your head as an erotica sentence. That's kind of hot.
Yeah, I just read that as I'm an abhorrent douche. Okay. So this year, if you're headed home to the household that still thinks a sex-offending game show host in rapid cognitive decline was the best choice for president, it is your civic duty to filibuster Thanksgiving. Now, he gives some ways you can do that, first of which is don't show up. The second of which is show up and be kind of an asshole. It suggests not hugging your family, only giving them stiff, formal handshakes. And then, of course, if you want to ratchet up the scorched earth technique, where you basically try to literally ruin everything, including ordering pizza instead of dinner. He says, order 10 Papa John's pizzas, the official foodstuff of the alt-right. So, Justin, there are many reasons to ruin your Thanksgiving with your family, not the least of which is that it's with your family. But would this be in your top 6 million?
What, talking about Trump?
Well, like, would this be a reason to ruin Thanksgiving because Donald Trump is president?
No, this would be, you know, my dad would just constantly talk about Trump. But you had this conversation with my dad, didn't you? When we went to the AFC Championship game? And, like, it wouldn't really ruin Thanksgiving. All it would do, it would turn into a lecture from my dad. Like, this wouldn't even ruin Thanksgiving. Like, he knows that I don't support Trump and it doesn't do anything. Like, this is not the way to ruin Thanksgiving. Look, people, as someone who's ruined many family holidays by accident, this is not how you ruin a family holiday, okay? Bring up politics is not how you do it. Because what happens when you bring up politics is either one dude rants and everyone just waits for the rants to end and then, as William said, move on to other more interesting things, or you become the dude ranting and they wait for you to finish so they can move on. politics are not going to ruin a family holiday. It's just not going to happen.
Also, if this was written, this could be a much better article if it was written as a parody article, because it's like 87% of the way there. The reason I say that is his whole point that I think he's trying to make is that you should, that there's only 36% of Trump supporters, you know, right now. And so if you chip away at it by doing these actions, you know, ruining Thanksgiving, it's going to help like convince them not to support Trump. And this gets back at what the left has been doubling down on ever since Trump was elected, ever since he won the primary, is painting all Trump supporters with this one broad brush that they're gun-toting bumpkins and are racist, homophobic, I don't know, list all your evil labels, Nazis, you know, all those things. And so you're not going to convince any people by calling them all these things and saying, well, you should just stop being those things and come over to the light side and don't support Trump anymore. Yeah. That's not how you, how you convince, that's not how you persuade.
What you're talking about, William, is one of the major problems I've had with the left my entire life, and why when I was younger I did identify as right and as conservative and as Republican. It's because whether the left does not want to admit it, they're the ones who more often than not are, and I don't even want to say more often than not, it isn't until what you're saying with what Trump is doing now and the right is doing now, and you know they've internalized this identity of Trump. But the left is the one who has this hostility and this negativity towards people who don't agree with them and telling them how awful they are. I have, in my experience, even in the stories I hear, it's the people on the left who start these fights. I mean, look at this article. This isn't in a right. This isn't the National Review telling you it's your civic duty to ruin Thanksgiving. It's a leftist publication saying that. And to me, that says something, and that's demonstrative of something. And now, you know, the problem in this country is now the right believes it's their civic duty as well, because they think the only way to fight the left is to be the left. And that's why I fucking hate both sides now. But this is the point we're at. They don't even see the irony of it.
It's and it's deeply, deeply flawed in its rhetorical thinking, because one of the reasons Trump has been able to be so successful is this, you know, named, I think, by conservative pundits, the Trump derangement syndrome, where anything he does describes the left insane and the media insane. This is literally just taking a giant shovel full of coal and feeding it into the Trump fire. This is what Trump supporters want you to do. They want you to be a whiny baby. They want you to throw a tantrum to, quote, build a mashed potato wall on the dinner table, which is hopefully the close to satire part that William was referring to. Because you know why they want you to do that? Because it would affirm everything they've ever thought about the left. Everything. And if you want Trump supporters to double down on their support of one of the stupidest human beings ever to hold the office of President of the United States, do everything he says in this article, people on the left. That will make his supporters double down, donate more, give more time, and do everything they can to get him reelected. So congratulations, if that is your goal, this article is your game plan for how to make that happen.
Is that the goal, or is the goal to drive people apart and to create this us versus them mentality? I say that because, speaking from personal experience, I just spent my first holiday with my girlfriend's family, and one of the things I was afraid of is, I'm a white person, this is in California, and they're all Filipino. So I figured that if I voiced any of my opinions at all, I might get painted as alt-right. So I was terrified of speaking my mind at all, because I didn't want, because we've seen this before where there was even the article, right, where it was libertarianism is a feeder school or whatever for alt-right. What was that article, Daniel?
Oh, yeah, I know what you're referring to, basically, that libertarianism is
it's just a gateway drug.
An alt-right conception. It's not a, yeah, it's, right. Yeah, there you go.
It's a gateway drug, right. So I was afraid that they were going to see that, because there's been an effort to paint anyone who's not left as alt-right, and alt-right meaning racist, right? I mean, it was even in the beginning when the term alt-right came out, it didn't mean racist, it didn't mean Nazi, but now in common vernacular, colloquially, it means that now. So, you know, I was terrified to go in as a white person and have people think that of me.
Yeah, Jordan Paul, Peterson and Dave Rubin are both alt-right in the social justice warrior classification scheme.
Right, and Jordan Peterson is pretty down the middle as far as I can tell. Yeah. He's pretty fair to both sides, and he's pretty critical of both sides. And that's the point. That's how I see myself, too, here in the Midside, and that's how I see our show, as pretty critical to both sides and pretty honest about both sides and as fair as possible to both sides. But I was afraid. But then I find out politics didn't come up, and I even find out later from conversations with my girlfriend, some of the people in that family even voted for Trump. Are you kidding me? So, you know what? There is more diversity everywhere than people realize. It's just the opposite effect is happening. Rather than opening up conversation, all it's doing is shutting down conversation. And because conversation's shutting down, it's shutting down the ability of individuals to interact with each other.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, does anyone have anything else to add on this, or do we want to talk about some art?
Please.
Let's do it.
Anything but Donald Trump.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to go backwards to more stuff about Sean Lasseter, because we're going to talk about the latest Pixar movie in The Hopeful Romantic with JML. All right, Daniel, it's time for you and me to have a discussion here, because Pixar released their latest movie, Coco.
Arriba!
Oh, man, I mean, you say that, but that was pretty much the whole movie. Let me share a little bit of my experience with seeing this movie. And, you know, first we'll talk about how there's always a short that airs before these movies that they put in before these movies.
Then
we'll
talk about this was a long...
It was. So I went and I saw this movie in the El Capitan Theater in Hollywood Boulevard.
Racist.
So this is where I'm about to say things that may be construed as racist, but
this I is think where that's Jimmy in Kimmel's the that's filmed. In the details. That's in the details in the on the podcast every week.
Things that may be construed as racist. The entire content of this episode. Yeah.
Not suitable for work or anywhere else. Yeah, so this is the same place that Jimmy Kimmel Live is filmed. It's a different stage, but they have movie premieres here sometimes. So I go with my girlfriend, I go with Christine, and there's a mariachi band playing beforehand. Apparently, the Mariachi Divas have won multiple Grammy Awards, and they were the opening act for the movie.
Okay.
But the first thing I noticed standing in line here is there's very few white people in line. Like, it's mainly Mexicans. Which is, I guess, is great because, like, they have a movie that represents them, so they want to see it and celebrate it on opening night. So that's the comment that could be construed as racist. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that's what the demographics were. But then I felt tricked. I felt tricked.
Sorry. Reminds me of a Bill Burr joke. Sorry, you'll appreciate this, but he says, when people say to me, like, I'm not a racist, but there are a lot of Asians in this room. He's like, that's not racist. There are a lot of Asians in this room. If you said, what are all these mother effing Asians doing in this mother effing room? That would be construed as racist.
See, that's so, the thing. Sorry, just... Like, I wanted to go to my girlfriend and say, hey, I said to her, I go, have you noticed something? And she knew I was going to say there are a lot of Mexicans here. And she goes, don't say it. I go, why not? She goes, because you're going to get yourself in trouble. It's like, I'm just pointing out that there are Mexicans here. It's a Mexican movie. What is the problem?
If you ask a Mexican in the room, are there a lot of Mexicans in this room? And they're like, I don't see race. That would be insane, right? That would be ludicrous. There are a lot of Mexicans there. That's a thing.
Right.
And if you go to Dia de los Muertos in Mexico, you're going to see a lot of fucking Mexicans. You're not going to see a representative sample of Filipinos and Canadians.
And I will say this. I was not bothered that there were no white people in this movie. It didn't cross my mind until, in fact, right now.
Okay. But you felt like you were tricked. Sorry.
I felt like I was tricked. And this is... The Mexicans probably agreed with me on this. I got tricked into watching white people stuff. And what I mean by that is, the guy steps up, right? The host of the El Capitan Theater. And he goes, so Olaf may be here. And then I went, fuck, there's a Frozen short here that's going to air before the movie. And then I went, wait, isn't Disney the one who does Frozen, not Pixar? Like, I want to see a Pixar short. But then it was worse. Before the fucking movie started, one of the goddamn costume people who play Olaf came out and danced while the goddamn song from Frozen played, and then the supposed Olaf short started, and it was like half an hour long, to which I leaned over to Christine and I went, I feel like I got tricked into seeing a Frozen movie. Like, when is the movie going to start?
Yeah. There was a warning on our theater door in like giant type that said, warning, parents, there is a 22-minute Frozen short before this film. Oh my god. In fact, I think the short is still going on. Yeah.
And I can't tell, was it bad or good? Like, I don't even know.
It was Frozen. Like, it's Frozen is not bad or good. It's just like this perfectly algorithmically designed cartoon in order to get all little children, especially young little girls, to scream in order to buy merchandise.
Yes, algorithm is 100% the perfect description, because Olaf is like a cross between that fucking squirrel from the Ice Age series and Donkey from Shrek.
That's right. That's a good description. I like that Venn diagram. Yeah.
Just like everything that happens in it, it's either like he fucks up somehow and then has to go back and try to do it again. Like, was that fruitcake loaf not the fucking acorn from Ice Age?
Totally.
And then he has these.
So did you? Go ahead.
He has these random pop culture references and things that it's like, huh, I get that, that are definitely donkey inspired. It's just, oh.
Did you notice that the word Christmas was mentioned maybe once or twice, but it was like ambiguously not a Christmas thing? In fact, Olaf sings a song literally titled That Time of Year.
Yeah, I noticed that.
That goes through, like he says, have a happy, merry, jolly, thankful, whatever, that time of year. And it was like, this is so blatantly PC. Like, you made a song that said, hey, just in case you're worried, we are PC. Please don't hate us. We are blatantly PC.
Well, yeah. And then, I did it. I got really confused as to what you're saying, because I was like, is this a Christmas short or not? Because during that song, they mentioned Christmas, and then they mentioned Hanukkah. And then they mentioned, like, a bunch of other, like were they holidays or made-up holidays? What was it?
I don't know. I was looking for Kwanzaa, but Kwanzaa wasn't in there.
Yeah, I was waiting for that as well. Yeah. And then the fucking...
A lot of white people in the Frozen universe. Yeah.
When we're talking about Frozen, the other thing we have to talk about is the fucking guy, Kristoff. Like, could they make men look any stupider? Like, he has this dumb troll holiday, and, like, everything he does is stupid. Like, his horse is smarter than him. His horse is, like, doing, like, charades, and he doesn't get it. And then the two women come in, and they say everything the horse is getting. It's like he's dumber than his horse.
And isn't it Olaf who tells her, you're a princess, you don't have to settle?
Yeah. Goddamn.
Wow. Overall, that was terrible, and that was a huge portion. All I could think was, the parents must be so pissed right now, because we are 24 minutes into a short after 24 minutes of trailers, and we have not yet begun the movie.
Daniel, my movie was supposed to start at 10:50 p.m. I'm in a room with a bunch of Mexican families with Mexican children 10 years old and younger. At 10:50, they're still playing the mariachi band. Then the Disney previews come on. Then Olaf dances. Then I have to watch this short. The movie didn't start till an hour after it was supposed to start. I imagine that the Mexicans around me were like, fucking white people making us watch their fucking white movie. And I was like, this has nothing to do with me. I hate this as much as you do.
We just came here to see Dante. Where's Dante? Yeah. I can do that because I'm Mexican. If any of you do that, that's racist as fuck. Just so you know.
All right, so let's talk about Coco a little bit here. I think you should go first, because you're the Pixar guy. And I'm not, that's okay. Not a setup. Coco. That's not a setup. I want to be clear that I liked this. So go ahead.
Coco is the story of Miguel, who wants to be a musician, but his family has this thing against music because their matriarch of many, many years ago, his great-great-grandmother, I think, or maybe there's another great in there.
No, great-great.
Was left by a musician, and she had to raise the family on her own. And basically she declared that no one in the family will be musicians ever. So, but Miguel has a drive to be a musician, and he finds out that his father was a famous musician, and through the power of Disney magic, he gets accidentally transported to the world of the dead, where the only way he can return is to get the blessing of his family, except that his family will only give him the blessing to return to the land of the living if he promises never to play music ever again, and if he breaks that promise, he gets sent back to the world of the dead. So that's kind of the plot without revealing any of the major twists and spoilers and storylines and whatever, and we'll try to avoid that.
Yeah, all so I'll a say couple about things. The twist is... Yeah. At a certain point, it became super obvious to me, and I leaned over to my girlfriend and said it. And then, like, yeah. The twist was revealed, like, 10 minutes later. And right before it was revealed, she went, oh, that. And I went, that's what I just said to you 10 minutes ago.
Briefly on that point, I thought the twist was obvious while still being well executed.
Oh, yes, 100%. So, and that stands as a testament to the movie, because not everything has to be unpredictable. Just because it's obvious doesn't mean it's bad. And this is a perfect example of a movie where the plot construction was obvious, but it was obvious because it was right and proper.
Here's what I will say about Pixar. I've watched a couple movies this holiday weekend and trying to do something that you people call relax, which is weird. I don't know. This is a foreign concept to me. I tried not to do work, which was very strange. So I watched some movies, including some animated movies, and it just stood out to me with watching Coco that Pixar is just in its own category of storytelling. Aside from the animation, which was unbelievably good, and aside from the humor and the writing, the sort of character writing, I mean, the storytelling, the plot, the reveals, the progression, the plot theme, all of it being integrated into a masterful story that Pixar told that was interesting. It was, paced well enough that it kept adults and children entertained. It was revealed properly and had a great ending. I think overall, this is probably, it's certainly in the top half of Pixar movies. It's probably in like the top 10 Pixar movies that they've done, maybe top 8 or 7 or something like that. Like, it's a very good movie. Now, talking about the animation in particular, like, holy fucking hell. The animation in this is insanely good. Insanely good! The whole Land of the Dead, Justin, with the complexity of the animation, this whole Land of the Dead is basically done as if it's like this hugely complex city with layers and layers and layers. And I think, like, beforehand, the little skit that they had said that they like animated 8.5 million lights for this city.
You mean the little
8.5 million?
The little skit that came after Frozen. And I was like, can we just watch the fucking movie already? Like, I would have appreciated that so much more in any other context, but in this context, I didn't care.
Yes. And if anyone wants to know just why Pixar is vastly superior to other animators, just watch the scene of Miguel watching the musician on TV in the attic, where Miguel's playing the guitar and there's candlelight and TV light, and the interaction of both the white light and the yellow light from the candles and the televisions with the guitar and the vibration of the fucking strings that was animated into this, it's beyond belief how good the animation is. So I'll let you sort of analyze theme, and then we can talk about that a little bit. But overall, this was an incredibly satisfying movie. Funny,
Save
heartfelt,
it.
Emotional, whatever.
At the end, we will talk about
but
why
then
people
I will
should
give my review at the end.
Right. We will, at the end, say why people should and shouldn't see this.
There you
and,
go.
And all that stuff you said will be part of that. So as far as the technical standpoint, starting with what you're talking about with the watching the old movies and such, From a writing perspective, everything pays off and everything has a purpose. And that's the way it should be. Like, I'm so tired of watching movies where there's just random shit in there that never comes back again. But when this movie wraps up at the end, it's everything in it served a purpose. There was a reason for everything. Now, I will say this. This is my biggest critique and maybe only critique of this movie. That made the beginning a little cumbersome and weird because they're introducing all of these different elements and it just sort of felt a little all over the place and a little quick with all of the introductions. At a certain point, I was like, I feel like I'm on drugs watching this. But then once he gets into the land of the dead and the plot starts to unfold at a reasonable pace, it works very, very well. And the payoff is phenomenal. Even if obvious, it's still phenomenal. So that would be sort of my one technical critique. As far as
plot agreed, theme, and I want to add to your point there, which is that, you know, compared to, say, something like Up, which is probably top three of Pixar movies, where the whole setup of the movie is like a 5-minute montage where no words are spoken. Like, this movie had relied really heavily on narration at the beginning. Yes. And thus, you could tell that it was going to be sort of complicated, because Pixar doesn't usually resort to that kind of narrative structure unless they have to set up something really complicated.
Well, and also, just from that, from a telling and not showing standpoint, I'm supposed to believe that he's some musician who has talents and he doesn't. How long does it take him to play fucking a note? A long time. Yeah. Like, why didn't it open up in him in his little secret room playing music and then something happens and go forward from there? That, to me, is a more logical starting point.
Right.
So,
agreed.
As far as plot theme, I was actually very appreciative of this because at the end of the movie, I was really, really worried that this was going to be about being selfless and the family being most important. And they actually had not only Miguel grow, but the other characters who are giving him the blessing grow as well, to give him his proper blessing to not only be part of the family, but be an individual. And to me, that's what this movie is about. It's about how you balance being part of a group and remembering and honoring where you came from, but also respecting each other enough to let other people be individuals, which from my family experience, I didn't have that at all. Daniel can attest to that. It's very much be part of the group or that's it. So I was very
GTFO.
Scared.
GTFO.
Yeah, exactly. And I was very scared that that's where they were going to go, but I was very appreciative that it ended in the way that it did. And the thing I like specifically about this movie is I love, love, love the concretization of the blessing. This is something that as children we look for from our family and we get our self-worth from it. And it's not unhealthy to say that. It's not second-handed. We get our blessing from our elders. We get our self-worth from our elders by saying, it's okay, you're a good person. And if you don't get that, what do you become? You become what Miguel was becoming. He was dying, literally, by being in the land of the dead. He was dying. If he stayed there without his blessing, he would have just become a dead person like everyone else. And it made him this, you know, this, as Daniel, you were saying, war of every man against every man. He was just off on his own as a rebel, not connected to anyone. This loner, this lone wolf. And it was destroying him. And I thought it was that was very well done as a concretization of the actual theme. And the way they also integrated art as part of that, like, this family was dying and it was a very cold family that didn't respect individuality because it didn't respect art and they got rid of music, which, you know what, that resonated with me as well, because when I was young, my mother said, we're not artists, and my family doesn't understand art and they don't understand why I care about movies and writing so much. So I just thought that this got a lot of it right, and it was so inspiring to see it done from a healthy standpoint, that you can balance this collective, this group we come from, and still be individuals, which is the biggest challenge of a family, is how do you have a group of people that the group is important, just like a team, but still maintain your individuality.
Right. And I think it shouldn't go without saying that Miguel in this story at several points basically says, like, look, I kind of want to like you guys, but if you're not going to allow me to live my life, you know, I'll go on my own. That will be a negative overall because I will die. But I am willing to give up my life to pursue the values that I want. And so that at the end, to have those things reconciled and that he doesn't have to give up his family in order to pursue his individual values was to me not only an excellent way to pay off that plot, but an incredibly needed message in our culture. And
well,
I think
right.
one that many children could learn from.
In fact, I don't necessarily want to say the antagonist, but I guess it is the antagonist. There are several antagonists throughout this movie, which is also adds to the complexity of it. But the fact that his family comes to understand his point of view because they misunderstood reality, and by reassessing reality and seeing the new parameters, they go, oh, wait, Miguel is right.
Yes.
Which is the other subtle thing I had. Go ahead.
No, it wasn't just like a mystical thing or a, you know, this is the way it's always been kind of thing. It was, look, we had this interaction with this musician who left us and made things really hard for us, and thus we don't want that to happen down the road. And when the facts of that situation were changed, not to reveal too much about the ending, when the facts of that situation were changed, the family did change their mind. And that is so different from what you typically see of the sort of plot climaxes where people just sort of magically change, or like magically have this change of heart, or mystically decide that the main character is right, which I fucking hate. This sort of non sequitur transitions. This had a perfect change, like a great reason why the climax happened the way it did, which is sorely missing from art.
It's sorely missing from reality. I mean, at least from my experience, it doesn't matter how much you show people reality, usually, especially my family. Like, it doesn't change anything. They just continue to think I'm the wrong one. So it's good to see the idealized version in art. But also, a subtle thing I haven't really mentioned is this was also a portrayal of trauma and the way trauma is passed down from generation to generation, and how trauma can be fixed by accepting reality and realizing what's going on, rather than just having to fall into this protective shell. Because in a way, his abuelita who was carrying on the trauma that his great-great-grandmother and great-grandmother felt by the musician leaving them, right? He was essentially a deadbeat dad.
Yeah.
So that trauma was passed down all the way to his abuelita, who was essentially acting narcissistic. She didn't care what anyone said or thought. They were just not allowed to play music, and that was it, because that was what she was experiencing, because all she wanted to do was protect her mother.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it was a great even portrayal of the idea of trauma being passed down.
Totally.
All right, so
one of the best movies I've seen this year. So
yeah, agreed. Definitely. I'd have to look back. I don't even remember like what came out earlier in the year, but it's definitely one of the better ones of the year so far. So beyond that, why should people see this movie, Daniel, and why shouldn't they see this movie?
I guess the two reasons to see it would be, one, if you really want to see what storytelling should look like. Like, so many times we just see movies that are just a series of images sort of cobbled together and then put on a screen, but that's not really a movie. That's just a sequence of moving pictures, as you might say. But if you want to see a story, like an actual story, even if you don't end up liking the story, this is just a beautifully constructed story. So go see that. And then two, the art is just unbelievable. Like, the visual artistry of it is so good that it's worth seeing. I wouldn't see it if you hate ranchero music, because it will drive you fucking insane. But overall, I thought they did the Spanish guitar stuff really well and sort of cut down on the polka nonsense. That will drive you insane. And then two, this is a Pixar movie. It's a children's movie. Our theater was filled with kids. If you can't stand kids, don't fucking go see it. And this will come up later in Reddit when we discuss some things. But
I do not like your anti-polka music stance as a Polish person. I find that to be a microaggression.
Polka, in its pure form, its Polish form, is a decent art form. And if you go see like a polka band, a good polka band, they're good. When it's mixed with the weird Mexican ay-ay-ay stuff, like, it drives me insane.
Okay, that is an acceptable backtrack.
Okay,
you're forgiven.
Thanks.
All right. You should see this movie if you want to figure out for yourself how to balance family with the individual. I think this gave me, actually, I learned something. I'm an adult and I learned something from this movie. And maybe you can learn something from it too, which is perhaps the second reason to see this movie is, as Daniel said, you can find value in this even if you are an adult. So if you have kids and you want them to be entertained, but you as an adult want to be entertained as well, to me that's something that's rare, because movies that are for adults nowadays aren't even deep enough for adults. Why shouldn't you see this movie? You shouldn't see it in theaters if you fucking hate Frozen. I'll tell you that. And also, you know,
if you're on a tight schedule, don't go see this movie.
Yeah. And as Daniel said, you know, I'm going to go more general with it. If you really want Donald Trump to build that wall, do not go see this movie. You are just going to get very, very angry. When I was watching this movie at a certain point, I go, there's probably a segment of population who's really mad at this and say this is part of the agenda to normalize Mexican-American and immigration and stuff. It's not about any of that. Ugh. It's just a good movie, and it happens to be told in Mexican culture. It could be any other culture that they could have done this in. They just wanted to use the Day of the Dead to tell this story. And, you know, Mexicans are known for having very large nuclear families, right? They really care about all the generations. So that's why they use this. It made sense to use Mexican culture to tell this specific story. But if you have a problem with that, don't see it. And also, you probably hated our review. And I don't care, because you know what? It's a good movie.
And also, fuck off.
Yeah, that too. But I didn't want to like be one of those people who's like, and if you're racist, don't listen to our show. No, everyone can listen.
No, you can listen, just fuck off.
Yeah. I agree with that statement.
Oh, but tune in. 5-star review. Just fuck off.
All right. Yeah. Let's talk about some stuff that's going to come out.
Trailer takedown. First trailer.
This is the all animated edition, Daniel. So first we're going to talk about Smallfoot. Mm-hmm. Smallfoot is about Yetis / Bigfoot who have the myth of the Smallfoot, a.k.a. the human beings. This trailer was really just a teaser trailer, I think, and it was about a Yeti telling the story of the horror story of the Smallfoot, the humans existing, to a bunch of children, and then someone brings out a little Smallfoot shoe, and they all get scared and run away. For me, though, I like this concept a lot. I think it's really creative. I don't know much beyond that, but just based upon the concept, I want to see this. Hug. Daniel?
Looks amusing. Got a little bit disappointed only because I saw a screenshot of the trailer, and I thought just from the small screenshot that this was going to be a spinoff of like Monsters, Inc. with the Yeti, who is a great John Ratzenberger character. And it's not. It's a Warner Brothers movie. So a little bit disappointed there. But, yes, I think in this small clip, the concept was interesting enough that I can easily give this a hug.
Hug!
Oh, speaking of screenshots of the trailer, if you screenshot all the cast, it does say LeBron James is the voice in this movie, so that's a knock against it. Yeah, I'm not so sure about that. I don't really. If they want us all to hate the human, because I'm not
if
ready
he's
for
the
LeBron
small foot,
James.
That would
actor,
just be
no, I think
ironic.
he's Gawanji, according to IMDb.
So yeah, the human.
I don't know. No, he's a purple. He's a purple Yeti. It looks like.
William, one-eyed, one-horn, flying, purple people eater?
I guess. I had a very similar reaction, Daniel. I saw the poster before I clicked on the video, and I thought this was an Ice Age spinoff because the poster looks like an Ice Age poster. But I'm going to tentatively hug this. I'd be interested to see what it's really going to be about. It looks creative and interesting, so we'll see.
Hug! Second trailer.
Peter Rabbit is a live-action animation mix of the Peter Rabbit story that seems to be reinterpreted. So Peter Rabbit is living with Rose Byrne, and they're living in perfect harmony as humans and animals must share nature. And then her evil neighbor shows up, and her evil neighbor is played by the redheaded ginger guy who's the evil guy in the First Order in Star Wars. But he hates nature, and he thinks, I have taken over my land, and they are not allowed in my garden. The wild must be in the wild, and this is my non-wild area. But then he takes it a step further, and he tricks Rose Byrne into dating him. So Peter Rabbit and him start a feud. Which I don't know how you start a feud with a talking rabbit and aren't like, wait, this guy's sentient and like as smart as humans. Maybe I shouldn't kick him out. Another discussion. So they start a feud while Rose Byrne likes them both. And that's the movie. I am tackling the shit out of this.
Tackle.
All I could think of was Rose Byrne is going to fuck a rabbit. That's all I could think. I was watching the trailer. This looks god fucking awful. This is, I mean, talk about a reinterpretation of a story. Like, Jesus, what a bad reinterpretation. But there's like a fight scene at one point between a rabbit and a human. No, just no, stop it.
Bring back Elmer Fudd versus Bugs Bunny.
Yes, that'd be way better. Just because, we've said this before on the show, just because a property has name recognition does not mean anyone was clamoring to see it. So please learn from that, studios, and hard tackle.
Tackle.
This is Alvin and the Chipmunks meets Home Alone, and I'm sure that's what the pitch was in the pitch meeting. Tackle.
Tackle.
I did get the Home Alone vibe from it as well.
That's funny. I really like that.
Final trailer.
The Incredibles 2 teaser. It aired or was broadcast or run, I guess would be the word, before Coco. And I'm, again, going to let Daniel go first on this, but I will say, basically, it's just Baby Jack getting powers.
Yeah, this was a teaser, so we didn't get much. But we saw that Baby Jack had powers at the end of Incredibles 1. So not a huge reveal. I guess it'll just be his story, or it's going to focus around him, I guess, which would be kind of cool. Long-awaited sequel. The Incredibles is probably my second favorite Pixar movie behind Finding Nemo. It's so well done and had a sort of, you know, not objectivist, but you could just say rational overtone, I guess, to it. Been forever, though. It's been forever. I'm super excited about this. It's obvious hug for me.
Hug.
What I'll say is that I saw an interesting / funny / revealing meme going around that was like, why did it take The Incredibles so long to make a sequel? And then it zoomed in on Mr. Incredible's sweater. And you could see, like, they have animated, like, literally every single fiber of his shirt and every single arm hair on his body. Like, the amount of detail that's going into these animations now is beyond belief. So, can't wait to see what that looks like.
Yeah, I mean, you say that it's been a long time since an Incredibles movie. I'm actually not a huge fan of the first. I feel like I constantly should rewatch it because people hype it up a big time. But people cheered in the theater when the teaser came on. And when I was at Disneyland recently, there was Incredibles stuff everywhere. And I don't mean like in the park. I mean people wearing Incredibles stuff everywhere. So this franchise is apparently incredibly popular. And I actually...
Beloved.
Beloved. Yeah. Okay, it's beloved. And I actually find the idea of a movie about a baby getting powers, I find that interesting because the superhero genre, as we know, is very oversaturated. And this seems like a new direction to take it. So I had forgotten that that happened at the end, and I thought it was a big reveal, but I hope that's the plot of the movie. And because of that, hug.
Hug!
William?
Yeah, I'm all in. I was a fan of the first one. I've watched it a few too many times, I would guess. I got to see this before the Justice League movie for the first time. Got to see the teaser trailer and the same experience. Everyone cheered. It seems like a very benevolent and uplifting sort of story. The first one was, so I'm assuming that's what we're going to get more of the same in the second one. So big gay hug.
All right, maybe we can find some other things for you to give a big gay hug to. Let's round out this episode in Reddit on Reddit.
These things are all on Reddit. Mostly pics of felines, comma, boring felines. These things are all on Reddit. No, we didn't post it, but we will repost it.
First, Reddit. What are your movie theater pro tips? Daniel, this is what you were alluding to before. I assume you're going to say something about children. I am going to say two things, or three things, before You do that. The first thing is your liquid intake. Before you go to the movies, don't drink for a little bit before you go to the movies, and then go to the bathroom before the movie starts. Nothing is worse than you fucking getting up in the middle of the movie and be like, excuse me, because you have to go to the bathroom. That is the worst thing, and you also miss the movie. Two, get a movie pass.
Yes.
It's currently, what, $9.95? And did you get the email, Daniel? I don't know. I got an email that if I pay it upfront for you, it'll even go down to like $7.50 a month. So if I pay it all at once?
Yeah, if you buy the annual subscription, right? If you're currently a subscriber to MoviePass, which, by the way, is for the uninitiated, you get to see one movie a day, or one movie every 24 hours.
And you can't repeat movies, though. So if you go see it, you can't see it every day. Once you see it, that's it.
You can only see a movie once. You can only see a movie once every 24 hours. But for that privilege, it's $10 a month, which is insane. And then, so if you're seeing two movies a month, you're well making that up in ticket cost, especially if you live in goddamn California.
Well, I actually tricked the system and used it for something even different. So in Downtown Disney now, even if you park, you have to pay, even without, you know, it used to be 2 hours free, but it's not that anymore. But if you get a movie theater ticket, you get validation for 4 hours. So I didn't go see a movie, but I wasn't going to see a movie within the next 24 hours. So I used my movie pass to purchase a ticket, and I got myself 4 hours of validation.
Gaming the system.
Yeah.
But anyway, the point is, if you buy the annual subscription now, it goes down to, ours is $6.95 a month.
Yeah, that
was a little more expensive in Southern California, but $6.95 a month, which is ludicrous. So that is a great pro tip, anyone out there. No Movie Pass is not a sponsor, although if they're listening, we'd be happy to take your money.
Yeah, so I definitely advocate that. I don't know if it's after a year they're going to go up. I don't understand how they're making money right now. I'm assuming they think it's like gym memberships, where if they get enough people to subscribe, enough people won't use it. So they're making free money by people just having a subscription they're not using. Is that what you think, Daniel?
Yes, I think they're getting a lot of people hooked, and then they're going to raise the prices.
Okay, well, I hope they don't raise it too much. That's my one fear. Final pro tip, find a movie theater where you can reserve seats and just buy the fucking tickets online, and then your seats are reserved. You don't have to get there early to get a good seat. You don't have to deal with the crowds and everything. This is coming from someone in California where there's always crowds. If you get a theater where they have reserved seating, it makes your life so much easier.
Do you have a preference for seating, Justin? Because I tend to think that the best seats in the entire theater are the first row behind the aisle where you come in. Meaning there's no one else sitting in front of you, and there's usually a rail that you can put your feet on.
Everything
people think
you have
that's
just
too
said,
close.
I know, my girlfriend thinks that's too gross. Christine thinks it's gross, but I agree with you completely, especially with the putting the feet up.
Yeah. You can put your feet up. Don't have to worry about it. No one's going to be walking in front of you, you know, to come in late or whatever. Like, to me, that is the ideal seat.
Yeah, the
movie going experience.
I agree. I think I really like the theater by my place in Redondo Beach, because all the seats are the reclining ones, right? So that opens up the seating possibilities a lot. Normally I would 100% agree with you, but in that particular theater, you can go back a few rows, and I'm one of those people, if I sit too close, like I actually can't, this is going to sound really stupid, but I can't hear the movie because there's too much like visual stuff. And like, I can't follow the dialogue because there's so much like flashing and like exploding and everything else. So I have to sit far enough away so that I can, you know, overwhelm my sight so that I can actually like listen to what's going on.
Yeah. So I don't have that many pro tips outside of what Justin said. I have a couple things though. One is, many places sell kids snacks. So like Regal last night for, Coco was selling something called a Zap Pack, which is like $6.50 or $6.80 or something. And it's a container of popcorn, a small fruit snack, which you can exchange for any small candy you want, and a small soda. That is unequivocally the best deal in all of going to moviedom. Like, if you were to get comparatively a small popcorn and a small drink, that's $11.50, which is outrageous. But the Zap Pack has a perfect amount of popcorn, a little bit of candy, and a drink. For like
$6.50. Go to Target. Go to the 99 cent candy aisle.
No,
nobody stops
I don't
you.
Wanna. I know. I'm a rule follower. I follow the rules. So.
I used to feel guilty about it until the security guard one day saw I had a soda. And he's like, do you have something there? And I'm like, no. He's like, just show it to me. And I'm like, no. He goes, dude, I don't care if you brought a drink in. I just care if it's glass. I showed it to him and he goes, enjoy your root beer. So the second the security guard did that, I know that the theaters don't actually care.
They don't really care, but they kind of do care, but they don't really care. And plus, I want popcorn. I'm not going to bring my own popcorn into a theater. That's a little bit too far. That's a bridge too far for me.
Okay, Justin, pro tip for movie theaters, don't eat popcorn. All it does is get stuck in your teeth, and you just get a hollow feeling after that you didn't really eat anything. It's just empty calories. Don't eat popcorn.
Popcorn during a movie is the only time popcorn is acceptable, and it's more delicious because you're in a movie theater.
I agree with you.
What?
I agree with you. My pro tip, just to squeeze it in because it's popcorn related, I'm weird. I'm a weirdo. I bring my own butter because I do not like the fake ass oil that they put on the popcorn. I bring my own butter. I love buttered popcorn. I hate hydrogenated corn syrup or whatever they use on the popcorn in the theater. So yeah,
that is hardcore. Brings his own butter. That seems really anti-gay to me, but I don't know why. Okay.
Moving on. Anti-gay to you? That seems super
gay.
Yeah,
that doesn't seem... Really? I don't think that's something... Like, if I talk to my gay friends, I think they would say, like, oh, that's way too much effort. Like, yeah. Anyway,
I think
okay.
Maybe it's because you're not LA gays. For LA gays, that seems super appropriate.
No, LA gays don't eat popcorn. Makes sense. Because it's calories. It's carbs.
Well, that's true. I said the more LA gay thing. I don't know what that means.
My last thing is not really a pro tip, but it's kind of a pro tip, but it's not a pro tip, which is we saw like a 7 o'clock showing yesterday of Coco, which is prime time families. We knew it. I partially do it because I've come to terms with the fact that my wife is a movie talker and it's just never, I'm never going to get her to change. It's just not possible. It's like asking a mountain to move. And so we used to do things in LA, like go to this is going to be wildly racist, but we used to go to the predominantly black theaters because, well, there's a lot of talking that goes on during the movies, and my wife doesn't stand out, and it's awesome. But we go to showings of children's movies when there are lots of children because children are movie talkers too, and it's not a big deal. If you are the type of person, like the goddamn scumbag of a human being who sat next to us last night at the theater, who doesn't want any talking during your movie, none, zero, zero. Like, you can't tolerate someone whispering during the movie, which this guy could not. Why the fuck would you choose the 7 o'clock showing of a Pixar movie? Pick, like, the midnight showing or the 9 a.m. showing on a weekday or something where there are going to be fewer children. This guy was there, like, I think he was by himself, and he was just fucking livid that there was so much talking going on in the movie theater. It's children! It's children. What do you want them? And on top of that, by the way, there was a woman two rows behind us who was clearly mentally handicapped, who was making noises during the movie. And the guy would just make these, holy fucking disgusted sounds about this girl who was clearly mentally handicapped.
What would you guess pro tip, this guy's BMI was?
What's... Is 200% an acceptable?
Oh, man.
You made my point for me.
He was so pissed off at the children talking. And then, like, my wife, like, laughed loudly at one point at a joke that apparently only she thought was funny, which happens. And, like,
yeah,
he leaned
like
over
to
me.
With me where I laugh at things and then I go, why did nobody else laugh at the joke? That was really funny. And then Christine goes, that wasn't a joke.
Yep, that's Fiza. And the guy, like, leans over to us and goes, can you be quiet? And I said, no, can you get over yourself? Because, Jesus Christ, if you don't want any talking, stay the fuck home and rent a movie. When you go out and there are literally hundreds of other human beings, the chances are there's going to be some noise. Get the fuck over yourself. Pro tip, don't be a douche.
I will actually say that in the theater for Coco, I thought there would be a lot of talking because of the children. And like during the Wrinkle in Time trailer, a kid was like, I want to be in that movie. And everyone laughed afterwards. Kids got more laughs than I have in life. But the movie was so good that everyone just was quiet. They were in awe.
Yeah. I mean, our movie wasn't like, it wasn't rambunctious, but there were children being like, oh, wow, look at that. You know, that kind of stuff. And he was just not having it. Douche.
All right. Any final thoughts on this Reddit?
Nope.
No.
Next Reddit. Men of Reddit, what's one misconception about the male gender you hate? I think we'll all have some interesting answers to this. I just want to go with the stereotype that all men want is sex all the time. I think I have a pretty high sex drive, but there are times when I don't want sex because I have other things I want to do, or I'm really tired. So I've never really liked the stereotype that, oh, you know, women are the ones who get really tired and don't want sex. So that's just what I would say.
Mine is unequivocally that men, especially male, especially dads, are just fucking dumb. I cannot stand this. Oh, this new modern thing of like, oh, you know, I have children and a husband, so I basically have two children. You know, that men are helpless without women, that women are the one that run the households and whatever. Fuck off. I hate
it's
this.
Every
stereotype.
Home Depot ad, and I've never understood that marketing. Because it's mostly, at least in California, it's mostly like, you know, Mexican contractors that are shopping at the Home Depot. But it's always a helpless male and the woman pointing out which colors to use in the Home Depot commercial.
Can you imagine how mad Donald Trump would get if Home Depot ran an ad targeted at Mexican contractors?
That would send him off the rails. To be fair, the only people that shop at Home Depot are Mexican contractors who aren't watching these commercials because they don't speak English, and women who are doing DIY projects. DIY? Yeah. The men are shopping at Lowe's or Menards. Men shop at Menards.
Well, my...
You save big money at Menards.
My male stereotype that I don't like is the one about playing with children. I don't have any children of my own. So I play with my cousins and my friends' kids, and I love it. I get a lot of joy out of playing with kids. They're funny most of the time, unintentionally. Wrestling around and playing with them is fun. But I know I can't do that in certain situations without people thinking it's super weird or super creepy. Like, I'm here visiting my family, and one of my best friends from high school I'm still friends with. He has a son that's 8 years old. I have a play date. We're going to play video games this week because whenever I come to town, that's what we do. And I think some people would think that's really weird.
Yeah. It's so unfortunate. I like avoid children in public.
I asked this question.
I mean, other than going to see Coco.
Not for the reason you think. But how old are these kids?
8 years old.
Okay. Are kids less boring at 8 years old?
I think that I'm not looking for intellectual stimulation. It's more just having interesting conversations, seeing how them grow and change over time. That's the part that I value.
I guess if you see them enough, maybe that's the thing. I found, though, that when there are little kids, I get bored. So maybe I shouldn't be a parent. Maybe that's what I've learned this week.
We're not there yet. Put it back in your pants.
Got one more Reddit.
All right. That's what Christine said. But all right, last Reddit. Mm-hmm. Redditors who are clearly not the favorite child, how did that affect you? William, it sounded like early in the show you have something you want to say here.
Oh, I was thinking about this a lot because I think that if you asked my brothers and sisters, that early on, I think that I was the favorite, but that quickly changed to my sister later on. And now it's like, I almost never interact with my parents. Like there's some things that we can talk about, and you know, I love my parents, and they help me with some things. Like my dad's great about asking about fixing things, and And my mom's great about when I have cooking questions and we can talk about stuff like that. But it's really interesting how it's my sister that is the one that it's exciting. And at least my parents, you know, she gets all the Facebook posts about things and, oh, she's doing this, that, and the other thing. And it's just, for me, it's just sort of a laugh. But I know I read through some of these comments on the Reddit article, and oh man, there's some messed up parents out there in the world.
Justin?
Daniel, you're an only child, right?
Only child, bitches. Yeah.
Yeah, well, this question popped up when I was doing research. It was the first one on Ask Reddit, and I was like, well, guess I need to include this on the show. Because, Daniel, am I the favorite?
No. What's below least favorite?
Even in high school, people used to say I was the black sheep of my family. But here's the thing. That's for me, racist. It's not so much... It was a black guy who said that. So, no, it's for me so much it wasn't not being the favorite. It was sort of being gaslit in a way. And what I mean by that is I would be, you know, I'm smart. So I'd be like, you have a favorite. He's the favorite. And they would constantly deny the fact that they have a favorite, as if that is some mark against them as a parent for having a favorite. When in reality, if they had just said, yeah, you're right, and just moved on with their lives, I would have been fine. It's sort of like I have a favorite director, but I still love Christopher Nolan movies. Like
just like that.
Zach said, well, it's a bad metaphor. It's not a great metaphor, but you get what I'm going for, yes?
Yeah.
Sure.
Yes.
And like my entire life has just been a battle about that, about like my parents denying the fact that they don't like me, or maybe my mother just doesn't like me. I don't know. But the fact that they don't like me and I have to act like they do. And it's, you know, it affected my psychology. I always believe there's somebody out there who's better than me. That inherently, that's just the way the world is, because that's how I was treated growing up. That's how my family acted towards me, no matter what. So I just internalized that. So it's just about, you know, being honest with your kids and being honest with the reality of the situation. I think all parents have favorites. It's just making sure you're aware of that and you're honest about it and you figure out how to handle it if it comes up.
Yeah, and learning and understanding your child's values is super important. I think that's, you know, the main disconnect I would say with my parents is exactly that. There's very little understanding of my values, you know?
Right, exactly. And when you said that, all the stuff you could talk to your parents about, William, that really resonated with me. Yeah, I could call my parents up whenever I need anything and I need advice like that about like cooking or cleaning or things to buy, or I can always talk about the Patriots with them. But then it becomes a pushback with my mom because she doesn't have the deeper relationship with me based upon values, but she doesn't value or understand my values, so I don't care to talk about them. So it makes it so I have to have a very distant relationship because of that.
Yep.
So I admire the fact that you can have the type of relationship you have. All right, any final
only
thoughts?
Child, bitches.
Fuck off.
That's it.
Fuck off. All right, let's talk about...
Finally, that makes me the favorite and the least favorite, but yes.
All right, let's put a bow on this episode. What did we learn this trip? Daniel?
I learned that it's my civic duty to bring up my mom's Trump support every time I talk to her on the phone and just scream at her until she decides not to vote for Trump because of my screaming, which is super effective. The leftist, you scream.
Ironic.
It's super effective.
That's funny. That would be a funny mock RPG if someone made that online. But I'm assuming you're being facetious because I can't imagine your mom voted for Trump.
She absolutely voted for Trump.
Interesting.
All right. My mom, who explained to me at age, I think I was 8, maybe been 7, that an abortion is a woman's right to choose and it's her body, it's her choice. And she made me start a recycling club. That woman voted for Donald Trump.
Interesting. The world's gone crazy. What did you learn, mm-hmm. William?
I learned that there is a giant force field preventing black people from entering Cabela's and Bass Pro Shops, and that the outdoors is therefore racist.
Man, all this time I thought it was just hockey rinks they couldn't get into with the force field.
Technology has progressed.
There is ice. I guess it's kind of outdoorsy. Justin, what did you learn this week?
Maybe I shouldn't be a father.
Well, that's fucking deep. We don't have enough therapy time to get into that. But if you learned something this week, especially something therapeutic for Justin, why don't you tell him at the Midside, everywhere on the social medias, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, where all the social medias are sold. You can also go to themidside.com/podcast and listen to all the previous episodes of the show and delve deeper into Justin's flawed psychology. And you can go to iTunes and subscribe there, Google Play, subscribe there, leave a 5-star rating no matter where you subscribe. That's 5 stars. That's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 stars. Even if you're a horrible human being, leave a 5-star rating. Tell us that you hate us and that we're awful, and then fuck off. But 5 stars. Then, of course, you should... What else should you do? Oh, the store. I always forget about the store. Themidside.com/store, where you can buy a Midside t-shirt, classic logo, or a False Dichotomy Bro shirt, which is a popular one, or a Hail Snydra shirt. Show your Snydra pride more than ever now, post-Justice League. But if you want to help us out...
If you go to themidside.com/Justice League... you can sign a petition to get Warner Brothers to release the Zack Snyder cut of Justice League. It's up to about 140K at the time of recording. So I think that's a pretty significant amount if we can keep that momentum going. So just go to that link, sign the petition, and send that to some other people who you think would want to see that, because we all deserve to see what the movie actually should have been. Themidside.com/Justice League.
That's right. I'm going to sign right now. That's right. If you want to help us out financially, though, you can go to patreon.com/themidside, where you can choose to help us as artists deliver this podcast to you every single week. And you do that by signing up to give us a few bucks, maybe 50 cents, whatever you can afford, every time we produce a piece of content. So when we go on vacation later this year and no shows are released, you don't pay us. No money exchanges hands. But when we produce content, you hand over some money that helps us keep the lights on, and it helps us do things like advertise, get equipment, hookers, blow, etc. If you can't do that, that's totally fine. Tell a friend. Really, telling a friend is the number one way this show grows, because your friends, before you told them, did not know about the show, and then you tell them, and then what happens is that they know about the show. And that's another human being who, you may have already guessed, knows about the show. Math! So, we love math, and we love Lamp, and we love that you tell people about the show. So thanks so much, and until next time, much love be to you and your kin. Good tidings at Christmas.
This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin Emlesneski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day.